Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Joining us today is Lucy Kaplansky, a folk musician who has recorded more than half a dozen solo studio albums, including her newest release, Reunion, which focuses on the life story of Kaplansky's immigrant grandmother and the influence her Toronto bakery has had on the family ever since. During a career that has spanned more than three decades, Kaplansky has toured the world, collaborated with several respected producers and musicians, and worked in supergroups like Cry 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 and Red Horse. She also happens to be a PhD in clinical psychology and the daughter of a renowned mathematician. Lucy Kaplansky, as always, you're terrific. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so I guess let's start at the beginning. You were born where?
In Chicago, Hyde Park.
And do you have a Chicago accent? I don't hear it.
I think a little bit, but neither of my parents were from there, so I think I have a conglomeration of their accents, which were New York and Toronto. So I don't think so.
So who were your parents?
My dad, as you just mentioned, was a pretty well-known mathematician. That was the thing he did his whole life. He was an algebraist. He wrote many books. He ran a math institute. He was at the University of Chicago for 40 years. And my mom, being a woman of her times, was a homemaker. She was a mom and a homemaker and very intelligent, lovely, kind woman. My dad was very funny, very clever, and a great musician. I certainly got my love of music from him.
And you have a child?
I have a 10-year-old daughter. She turned 10 December 18th.
And when I heard this wonderful new album, which I really loved, I drive from Great Barrington to Albany every morning, and I heard the whole album, Lucy Kaplansky Reunion. You know, I love what you do because, unlike so many other singers, I can hear you. I mean, the words are clear.
That's good to know.
Words are clear. You don't hear that with everybody. The album is terrific. What do you mean by reunion?
So that came from this one song, and the song was born from a moment. Okay, so the moment was, and the background is that my dad grew up in Toronto, and his grandmother was an immigrant from Poland and started a bakery chain, health bread, from nothing. I mean, she started by selling out of her house, and then it became a very successful chain. And the whole family worked in the bakery. And then my dad was the only one who left. He got to study math on scholarship in the U.S. And he left and he was the only one. So everyone stayed in Toronto and the family really, the bakery was the family business. And so I got to do a gig. I've done actually several gigs in Toronto the last few years, but I played in Toronto last year just after my mother had passed away. And every one of my cousins, because my father had three older siblings, so they all had kids. So I have like 50 cousins in Toronto.
Wow.
And they all came to the show, and we got to visit and have dinner, and that was so emotional and wonderful. And then as I was closing my show, I was introducing a song that I'd written about my mother. And I realized, I think at that moment, and I shared with the audience, which, by the way, was mostly my cousins, not a lot of other people, that my mother and my two aunts, two mothers of people in the room that night, had all passed away within the last year, and that that entire generation was gone, and that we were the people who were left, you know, sort of the daughters and sons of those people, and that we were kind of all orphans in that room together. And it was one of those sort of unforgettable moments for all of us. And I started writing this song and it just hit me about that moment and about my dad and about his mother and about his brothers. And it hit me that that was a reunion. And then my husband, who's my co-writer, my husband, Rick Litvin, suggested bringing in the family reunion from when I was a kid, when we would go to Toronto. There was a big family reunion. And that's when the reunion idea came in. And then I realized the whole album was about reunions. It wasn't a conscious effort to tie together songs via a theme. It just sort of happened. And it really is about reunions.
Our father's gone. Here we are together. 40 years. is on. Here we are together, just daughters and sons. This is our reunion. This is our reunion.
Are you the most famous person in your family now?
Oh, that's a really controversial question, because I think my dad would say, I don't know what my dad would say. My dad's gone now. Who has more Google posts? I think I do, that, compared to my dad. But my dad was very famous in math, in the math world. So maybe I'm more famous. I don't know. My daughter asks me, are you famous? And I say, I'm a little bit famous. And that's my answer.
Wow. Let's talk a little bit about your PhD. It's in clinical psych, right? Is that what it is?
Mm-hmm.
You had to make a crucial decision in your life, which was, am I going to do that or am I going to do the singing? Our mothers would have said, you know what they would have said.
She did say. You kidding?
Something to fall back on.
Or
this is a living. So how did you decide that you had to do the clinical psych PhD first before you decided, okay, I'm going to do the singing?
So it's a story, because it's sort of I took a kind of, shall we say, twisted path, because really I started out as a singer. I always knew I wanted to be a singer, and I came to New York when I was 18 to be a singer, not to go to college, which was a very
interesting,
sort of controversial thing to do, coming from my neighborhood, which was all University of Chicago faculty kids. Like, you went to college, you didn't go off to be a singer. And then I ended up going to college for a year, and then I went and I dropped out. And I really was trying to be a singer, and then things actually started to go well. When I was 21 years old, I got a beautiful write-up in the New York Times for a show I did at Folk City, which is no longer there. And I just could not handle it. What happened was, I was too neurotically conflicted, I can say this speaking as a psychologist, to let myself have the thing I wanted. So I quit. And I said to myself, I don't want to be a singer. I'm going to be a therapist. So I went back to school, got a doctorate in clinical psych.
Where'd you do that?
That took at Yeshiva University. Uh-huh. First, I had to finish college, and then I went to grad school.
And where did you do your college?
NYU, which is when I met my husband. He was actually a professor there, although he was not my professor. He's a professor of film, different department. Actually, we met because he was a fan of mine. So that's a whole other story.
That is a good story. Let's take a short trip there. What happened?
Oh, sure. So I used to play at Folk City back when I wasn't being a student or a psychologist at Folk City, which is sort of this iconic folk club in New York.
Right, and my husband right near NYU. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. My husband used to hang out there, and he loved the music. And he had actually heard me on what's called a fast folk recording, which was this thing that happened in the early 80s. And I had recorded this Suzanne Vega song, Calypso, before she recorded it, because she was a friend of mine and she was unknown, just as all of us were. My husband loved that song and played it a million times. And one night I was singing there, and a friend of mine told me that his friend Rick, who was sitting at the bar, was a fan of mine. And I just went right up and introduced myself. And we've been together since that night. And my song Tenure Night is partly about us meeting. So he was a fan.
Did you know the moment you laid eyes on him that he was the one?
I knew after about 7 hours of talking to him. Yes, I did. He was everything I was looking for. And I felt so old and spinster-like at that point. I was 25, but in retrospect, I was just a kid, but I knew a good thing when I saw one.
Who made the move?
I did. He would never have made the move. Oh, yeah. No, he was too shy, so I had to introduce myself.
Yeah.
But he was right on it.
Oh, yeah. So, but it's so interesting from a psychological point of view. Papa was a professor, he's a professor. It becomes very comfortable, right?
Hadn't quite thought of that before. That's interesting. I know that my current life, which is being married to a university professor and living basically on campus, is very much like the way I grew up. I've been aware of that, but I didn't really quite think of the fact that I married a professor and my dad was a professor.
NYU housing? You guys are in.
We're not in NYU housing anymore. We used to be, but we're like a block from his office. We're a block from Tisch School of the Arts. So we're basically on campus.
I did my PhD at NYU, and I used to have to go to, you know, those three stark buildings that almost border Houston Street?
Yeah, Silver Towers.
Yeah, my professor, Dr. Padilla, would say, you have to come and see me, and the only time I can do that is at 4 o'clock in the morning. So I used to make my way through the dink and the dank and the dog stuff and get up there, and it was imprinted forever on my mind. You know,
why 4 o'clock in the morning? I don't know.
Because she had other jobs. She was the mental health something or other, and New York City Mental Health Board research director or something like that. And she was also running this program at NYU in politics and mental health. So that's my PhD's in politics, but, you know, we share the mental health part of it, which is the next question. You, of course, are a healer. You did a degree in clinical psych. So I guess I want to ask you whether your songs are meant to be healing songs also, as well as what you did with your clients.
You know, the only way I understand that is that my songs are just meant to be songs. Like, they're just an effort to write something that's real and good. And they're, if they are healing, and I get the feeling that on some level they can be, because people, especially this album, there's a couple of incredibly sort of gut-wrenching, heartbreaking songs on this album that are very, very, very personal. But it's amazing how the personal becomes universal because all of us go through losing our parents. People have come up to me so many times since I wrote a couple of these songs sobbing at the end of shows, like sobbing and saying how much that song moved them. So is that healing? I would like to think that sharing an emotional experience that is profound is a healing thing. I know it is for me when I hear something. Cheryl Wheeler wrote an incredible song about losing her dad that just moves me so much. So is that healing? Probably it is. But the songs are not meant to be anything other than just expressions that are hopefully well written.
But as a psychologist, you know, those things come from somewhere. In other words, you can say they're just songs. But obviously, it's who you are. That just listen to the names, everybody. Scavenger, The Beauty Way, Mother's Day, Life is Beautiful, This Morning I Am Born Again. Okay, let's stop there. I listened to that, and I was fascinated by it. You're Jewish, right?
Oh, okay, but that, I did not write that. That is a Woody Guthrie lyric. So, but... And it is a very spiritual song, but not about God in sort of the traditional sense. And that's one of the reasons I loved it, because I'm certainly not sort of traditionally religious, although I am Jewish. You're right. It's a song about finding spirituality and meaning in things other than what are traditionally thought of as meaningful in kind of organized religion. It's a incredibly beautiful, powerful song.
It's a wonderful song.
So, yes, it is.
And in it, he says, I'm born again, but then he starts to talk about the traditional way in terms of the usual invocation of traditional, you know, Christian thought.
Exactly.
In other words, and he names the things he doesn't, that he doesn't
expect. Streets of gold and mansions and the things that people associate with sort of being in heaven.
Streets of gold. This morning I was born again. A light shines in my soul.
He's not interested, and I'm totally down with that. I've just never bought into any of that. I think there's a way to be spiritual that has to do with being a good, generous, kind person and leaving some kind of meaningful mark on the world. That would be sort of part of my understanding of what it means to be spiritual.
So what is the connection with Woody? I mean, you know, Pete's out with a new album, How He Remembers Woody. It's phenomenal, by the way. And I just wonder what he represents to you as a folk singer.
Well, first of all, the best of the best. You know, no better writer really ever lived. And I guess he really, in some ways, really started the folk tradition that I'm part of, which is telling stories in a way that's interesting and not too, it's the word erudite, I think that's the word I'm looking for, but in a kind of basic, grounded way that he started it. And so many people have carried that torch, but he was the first or one of the first. So he's this iconic figure. And I mean, sort of like, I guess what I'm saying, he's sort of the father of this whole sort of folk singer-songwriter movement that I'm part of. And if you want to find a great song, go back to Woody Guthrie.
He was a communist.
I guess so. I don't know a lot about that, but...
No, he was. And of course, probably in the best sense of the word.
I was just going to say, that's right, yeah.
But it is interesting that he followed some of the twists and turns in the politics of the world. So that, mm-hmm. you know, he was singing peace songs until Russia got invaded. And mm-hmm. the Soviet Union got invaded. And he said to Pete, we're not going to do that anymore. We're not going to sing peace songs anymore. Now it's going to be all about the Reuben James, you know, and the war and the rest of it. Do you see any parallel in your career that, because you sing about personal things from within, but I don't hear a lot of political stuff other than if we're talking about a kid in the slums, you know, who needs some relief. Do you see yourself as a political person?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I am a very political person. I have very, very strong opinions about politics. I mean, that's a whole other conversation we could have right now.
Good, let's have it.
Okay. I'm a staunch liberal. I have very strong feelings about why liberalism is the way to be, why conservatives are kind of really trying to mess things up, especially Republicans. Do I bring that into the music? Well, first of all, I don't, partly because the only way I know how to write, and again, these songs are written with my husband, who's also a staunch liberal. The only way I know how to write is to write about what I know from my own life. That's just not to cast aspersions on anyone who writes anything that is more like more broadly political. It's just not the way I can write. That's A. And B, I get into so much trouble in my shows or even like my social media posts when I get political. People get offended. They say things to me like, we don't come to see you to hear you talk about politics. We don't want to hear it. So I've had to make a conscious decision, just leave that out. Like, that's not what I do. Now, I have taken stands on things I feel strongly about. The other day, I posted a petition, you know, for sign up for, you know, gun control. I mean, my God, that's a no-brainer. But in a bigger sense, I guess, I really stay away from it in my public persona because it doesn't seem to be what people want from me. They want the music. But personally, I'm extremely political. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I could prolong the agony a little bit.
Test
you a little bit. I mean, I get it. I truly get it that you don't want to alienate part of your audience. I face this every day, you know,
right.
on these radio stations, and to get people who say, I'm annoyed with you because you've said what you were doing. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, and look at Pete.
Yeah.
What would we have if we didn't have him? You know,
he certainly has alienated plenty of people
and doesn't care. I mean, I think that that's the thing. Let me go back and talk about this stick-to-itiveness which Lucy Kaplansky, you have. I mean, you know, there were a billion people with guitars and long hair and, you know, who started out and said, my boyfriend left me and I feel bad about that. And, you know, you just wrote from the heart and you just kept moving on with it despite the fact that shrinks are getting $200 an hour or more. So mm-hmm. what gave you that stuff that you have inside of you that allowed you to stay with the program, even when there were tough times?
I guess part of the answer is that I had a job. I was a psychologist, and I loved my patients, but I didn't love being a psychologist. So, in other words, I know what it's like to do something else and to not do this thing that I love and was meant to do. And having left it for years, I literally left it for years, I could never leave it again, because it's like I gave up once. I gave it up and was so miserable. So however arduous it is, and it is, I mean, and the hardest part is certainly being away from my family. That's a tough thing as a mother, although I make my trips very, very short. No matter how arduous it is, and no matter how lonely I get at times, it is the thing I love. So there's no question. So there's no choice for me.
How often?
I'm not going to give it up.
Lucy, how often are you on, you know, in an airplane? How many dates a year do you perform at?
A lot less than I used to before I was a mother. So now probably 100, which is way less. I used to do at least 150. So I'm gone. Let's put it this way. I'm gone Fridays and Saturdays most weeks. And then I'm home on Sundays most weeks. And I'm home the rest of the week. So I'm mom, helping with homework, doing pickup at school. So I feel like that's a sort of a compromise that seems to be working. Plus, my husband, who's a film professor, is at home on the weekend. So my daughter's never had a nanny. She's got mom or dad home. So it seems to work, and I get to do this thing that I love.
And there's a song on the album about, you know, kissing your daughter. I think it's about kissing your daughter, isn't it?
Yeah, the song Mother's Day?
Yes.
Yes. And that was written, I was away on Mother's Day, which I'll never do again. That's sacred now. I don't go away on Mother's Day. And I was incredibly depressed and miserable and lonely. And that song was born. And actually, I should just say that really that song was born. And this is, in light of recent events, this has taken on greater meaning. But I knew someone who had lost her young daughter, who had died of an illness. And I was devastated when I heard this, and this lovely woman. And that's where the song was born. Like, that how incredibly lucky I am and grateful I am to have what are ordinary days with my daughter every day, but are every day is extraordinary and kind of a miracle, because I have her and I get to wake up and be her mother every day, and how grateful I am.
Just an ordinary day. Hey, I kiss her face when she's awake. She tells me about yesterday. She brings me the card she made for me. Molly and Mom on an apple tree.
Where were you when you heard about Connecticut?
So I was home. So my husband and I, just after all these years together, made some music videos together. And we were just editing the first full-length one. It's for this song, Scavenger, that he and I wrote together. And he directed it, and I wasn't editing. I was just sort of sitting in the background looking at him and his cinematographer editing. And he punched up the Huffington Post, and we just couldn't believe what we were seeing. And we had like another hour of editing to do. And everything just took on a whole other, obviously, set of meanings. You know, I feel like anything I say about it's going to be sort of trivial, but I look at my daughter now every time I look at her. I think of what happened, and it's sort of unfathomable what happened. I have incredibly strong feelings about no one should have guns in this country. I don't care. Assault rifles, nothing. I don't think anyone should have a gun.
So has it changed you in any way? You know, I mean, I keep looking at this thing and I keep thinking. I interviewed somebody the other day who lost a beautiful, wonderful daughter who had graduated from Yale and was doing great social small s work and being fabulous and beautiful, and a drunk driver who had 7 or 8 DWI, was driving without a license one more time. And so guns and the concept of losing somebody like that. And I looked at the anguished parents who I was interviewing and I was saying, how can anybody survive this? I don't get it.
I don't get it either. A friend of mine who's since passed away, but a friend of mine who was a supervisor of mine when I was studying psychology lost his adult son. And I remember him saying to me, a part of me will never come back. Sure. And I guess you survive because you lose a part of yourself. I don't know any other way. You would clearly never be the same. And I don't know any other way of understanding it.
What kind of guitar do you play?
I have two Martins. I'm not an aficionado at all. And I don't even really consider myself a guitar player. I'm just a really sort of workmanlike guitar player. But I love Martins. And they're both little and they're very comfortable.
And you also play the piano.
Yeah, I don't consider myself a piano player. Yeah, my dad was a really terrific piano player. I can sort of accompany myself. I've never been much interested in practicing an instrument.
But we're going somewhere with this.
And yet,
if you listen to the great album, and the album for all of you who are listening to this now, is Lucy Kaplansky Reunion. If you listen to the album, you have some amazing accompaniments. Who decides who's playing with you?
So I've been working with the same producer now for six albums, I think, Ben Whitman. Fantastic, amazing producer and drummer and multi-instrumentalist. And he and I have chosen the musicians. But I've been playing with some of the same ones for years now. And, there's a lot of great players out there and a lot in New York. Mm. I've gotten to be friends with some of them. So I've Duke Levine, Zev Katz, Stefan Crump, just incredible. Larry Campbell, he's not on this album, but he's been on several of my other ones. Great, great players who are also the loveliest people and supportive of what I do. So I'm just lucky to get exactly who I want, and they like working with me, and Ben puts it all together, and I am so lucky.
How hard is it to do an album?
It's gotten easier. You know, it's funny, you learn how to do it. I guess you learn how to do anything. Mm-hmm. It was much harder when I first started, and now I feel like I've learned some lessons. One of them is, if I don't like what I'm hearing, I better speak up, because I'm never going to like it and I'm going to live with it the rest of my life. Don't be afraid to offend somebody and, you know, say, I don't like that part. And the other thing that Ben and I have gotten really good at is making my albums live, which means that I'm singing while the players are playing. And I mean, sometimes I'm playing too, mm-hmm. guitar. And that is a whole other sort of ball game. I mean, then you really are a band and you feel like a band and you sound like a band. And it's so much fun. So the whole thing is fun beyond anything else I do. It's the funnest thing I do. And it's quick. So is it hard to make an album? Yeah, I guess so. But it's unbelievably fun. And it is where I think I am the happiest musically, is recording and kind of coming up with creative decisions and singing harmonies. That's the best thing I get to do in music.
Now, you have fans. You have a lot of fans. And, you know, they yell up songs, you know, play this, play that.
Right.
And you've always been great and very responsive about that. But how does that feel when you're standing up there and people have come to hear you and know your work and want to hear their favorites? And yet you have new material. How do you balance things?
Well, first of all, it's thrilling every time. It's always thrilling that people know who I am and want to hear particular songs. And I'm always flattered. And I love doing requests. I mean, I never plan my shows. So if somebody makes a request and I can remember it, which in my, you know, older, I'm now in my 50s. Like, I can't always remember lyrics.
I'm 52. Okay.
So if I can remember the songs, I love doing requests. It really mixes things up. And my friend John Gorka says sometimes the audience really knows best what should come next. And he's right. Like, someone will yell a song, I wouldn't have ever thought of doing it right then, and I'll do it. And then the other thing I do, I don't know if you've ever seen me do this, but
indeed,
sometimes people
ask
me.
Indeed, I saw you right here at our Linda Norris Auditorium, right across the street.
Right. I don't know if that, sometimes people ask me to do stuff I've never done before. I mean, like, never. Like, a song I've never sung. It happened with this Bruce Springsteen song, which I've been doing ever since, which is Thunder Road. I'd never sung it. And I just thought, I'm going to try it. And sometimes those are the songs that end up being like this permanent part of my repertoire. So I love doing stuff I haven't done, and I love doing stuff I haven't done for a long time, and I love sort of taking chances up there. It makes it so much more fun.
We've had Dar Williams here. I've interviewed her. How important are having friends in the business, like you have with Dar and so many others?
You know, very. I mean, first of all, because we all kind of, we sing on each other's albums and we sing with each other at festivals. But just having this sort of community, and granted, we don't all get to see each other very often.
Sure.
And some people I'm closer to than others, but having a community is a really wonderful thing. And, you know, in at the level that we're all at, which is to say not stars, not particularly, not famous, not rich, it's really nice to have each other, and nobody's got too much of an ego, because you can't, because we're all sort of, you know, working hard and trying to make a living. And then some people I'm especially close to. I mean, my friend Richard Schindel,
sure.
He and I still do a lot of stuff together and love to collaborate. And my friends Elias Gilkison and John Gorka, we made an album, we collaborate. So it's really a gift being able to hang out with these people who make me laugh more than anything and sing with them. And I should say I love to sing harmony. That's also one of my absolute favorite things to do. And singing harmony with a great singer is just the best thing. So singing like with Eliza or John or Richard or Dar is just a great, wonderful experience for me.
I actually heard you on NPR one night. I heard they were pushing one of the common albums that you guys did. Mm-hmm. What happens after you go on the radio? Does anybody call you up and say, I heard you?
Yeah. I think it was me and John Gorka.
And
yeah,
it was NPR.
Yeah, it was Leanne Hansen. Yeah, that was really, that was great. Oh, my God, I was so nervous about that. What I do after a show like that, because I've been on one of those shows a couple times, and you get to sit and watch your Amazon number go to number one.
Without question.
Your iTunes number go to number one. So you sit on the computer all day and just watch that, and then get a lot of emails from people. Yes, I always, amazing how many people hear those things and call you or email you. It's very exciting.
The name of the album I want to tell everybody is Lucy Kaplansky, and it is Reunion. And Lucy Kaplansky is a favorite of the Chartok family. We play her albums all the time, and we love to hear her. So, Lucy, I guess I want to know about the future for you. I mean, you just said something. You said you weren't rich and you weren't famous. Well, we certainly know who you are. But let's concentrate on the rich for a second. Would you have been richer if you had stayed in being a clinical psychologist?
No, you know what? To be honest,
yeah.
I think very, very established, successful clinical psychologists make a lot of money, but I'm making a lot more money doing this. So that I just had to say that.
How do you make money in the business now with CDs? Or, you know, I said something to somebody the other day about, if you say that, will people not buy your CDs? And I was told nobody buys CDs anymore. How do you make money?
Yeah, you know, the business is really changing, but there's two sort of elements to that. One is that the record companies are definitely not selling nearly as many records. So, you know, my record sales via the record company, you know, via iTunes and all that, along with everyone else's, have plummeted in the last few years since iTunes, since downloading. But on the other side, I still sell just as many CDs at my shows as I ever did. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, people want autographs, they're inspired in the moment, they want the whole CD, whatever. So my living, I never made my living from the records that the record company sells. That's not how musicians make their money. Musicians make their money from their shows and from selling at shows. So it really hasn't affected me personally so much as a working musician. And I remember someone at my record company said to me a couple of years ago, and it really stuck with me, whatever happens with, you know, CDs not selling and record companies going out of business, there will always be a market for live music. And that, I thought about that a lot. Like, that's the truth. You cannot, you know, you can't make that virtually. I mean, you could put it on the web, but you can't be, you can't go to a live show in any other way than going to a live show other than watching it on the web. So people will always go to live shows. And hopefully when they go to live shows, they'll still buy CDs. So I'm making a living.
So it's all about touring now, right?
I mean,
if you don't tour, you obviously, what you just said, is you can't sell the records. You can't sign them. You can't sell them. And somebody comes in, you get a certain amount of money. But if everybody's lined up, as I've seen it at the Guthrie Center a number of times, to buy somebody's album, that's all cash, right?
Yes, exactly. That's how we, people like me, make a living. That's exactly it.
So
that's okay.
Tell me, Lucy Kaplansky, tell me a horror story of touring.
Oh, my God. Oh, boy. There are a few. Okay, let me take a second. I got to prioritize here.
Sure. Top 10 horror stories.
Well, okay, so there's a part of my life that we didn't talk about, which is that when I quit music, back when I decided to go back to school, college, and then grad school. And actually, I guess I didn't finish that story about how I went back to music. Maybe I should tell that.
Yeah, my fault. Go ahead.
No problem. So I went to grad school, and when I was in school, my old friend Sean Colvin said, let's make a record together. I want to produce a record. And I had, you know, I supposedly quit. And I said, sure. So we got some money, and she produced it and ended up being my first album, The Tide. And by the time I got it together to actually send it out to record companies, because, of course, I was so neurotically conflicted, I didn't send it anywhere. By that time, Sean was getting famous. And Red House Records, Bob Feldman loved it and put it out. And I was working as a psychologist then. And then things started to go really well with that CD. Well, it was a record then. And I ended up being too busy to keep working. But I left out the salient detail. Actually, let me backtrack for a second. So made this record with Sean, finished grad school. Now, why did I end up going back to music? Because I started seeing a really good therapist right around the time I finished grad school and had started being a psychologist. And within a few months, I mean, anyone with like really a brain would have looked at me and said, Lucy, you obviously, you're really good at music. You obviously want to do music, because I was still doing music. I just was telling myself I wasn't. And he picked up on it. And one day in a session, a few months after I'd started with him, I was saying something about, I wouldn't want what Sean has, Sean Colvin, meaning, well, I wouldn't want to be famous. I wouldn't want to be rich. I wouldn't want to be doing big shows. And he said, why not? And I didn't have an answer. Now, that's a really obvious question, but of course no one had asked me. And that's my memory is that's the moment that changed my life, because I started to wonder, my God, I do want it. What am I saying here? And that was the beginning of me really trying to have a career again. And I was petrified, because I had walked away from the whole thing. I had nothing going on except this album that had not been put out, that Sean Colvin had produced. And I managed to get that album to Red House Records. And I managed after that to get a booking agency. And then I got an NPR, and things started to go really well. And then I needed to give up psychology, because I was too busy with music. And that was a very hard decision, too, because I'd spent all those years and all that money becoming a psychologist. And I remember saying to my husband, I think I need to give up psychology. And he said something like, of course. And that was it. And I never looked back. And I felt badly about leaving my patients, but it was so clearly the right thing. And I never, ever looked back. So that's the long, twisted story.
Did a patient ever look at you and say, I heard you?
Yes. A few times, actually. Yes. And I don't want to say more than that,
yeah, sure.
but you know what I mean. Yes.
Sure.
Yes. So that was a little awkward. But, you know, as they say in the therapy world, it's all grist for the mill.
Not that awkward, depending on how you play the bounds.
Yes, that's right.
So let me ask you, go back to that other story, the other question of tales of horror from being on the road.
Right. So before, when I was in grad school, I was doing gigs as a country singer. I don't know if this is going to qualify because this is pre-singer-songwriter life.
Okay.
I'll take it. Does that qualify?
Yes.
Okay. So I was doing gigs just to make money as a country singer. And I remember one memorable night. Well, granted, I was playing in a band, so at least I wasn't on stage alone. But, you know, we played in a stable, and basically the audience was horses. So that was a low moment in my life.
Anybody ever hit on you? I mean, you're an attractive woman. Did that ever happen?
Thank you. Yes.
I mean, being a star has certain, I know you don't consider yourself a star, but being a star quality or star has certain risks to it. You know, there are some awfully disturbed people out there. The good thing is you'd know it when you saw it.
Yeah, actually, that's one advantage I have, having actually studied psychopathology, is I do know it when I see it. I have had some disturbed people following me around, although I've heard much worse stories from other musicians. But I know how to keep what's called a benign distance.
Well, that's interesting. We saw Natalie Merchant one night get accosted from the audience. I've never seen anything like it. She was playing in Pittsfield, and it was really horrible. And they had to escort the guy out of the theater.
Yeah, that hasn't happened. I've been really lucky, and I think because I'm not really well-known, maybe that stuff hasn't happened to me. My audience is mostly incredibly lovely, sane people. I'm still trying to think of a horror story. You know, it's funny. I guess I haven't had very many because I'm having trouble coming up with anything. I mean,
Well, the horror story was good. I mean, I've walked in to give I've walked in to give speeches at places and seen, you know, five people sitting there. That's not good.
Yeah, I've definitely had small turnouts, but nothing like horrible. Like I've had friends tell me where they had nobody show up. I've never had anything like that.
Right.
I'm happy to say.
Right. Do you ever think about your friend Sean and Dar? That there are a lot of people who think of those names and say, and I'm one of them. He sang that song. They both have names that could be boys' names.
Oh.
Did you ever think of that?
I never thought of that. I can tell you that, no, I've never thought of that, but I can tell you that I've always been tortured by my own name. Like, I remember when I met Sean, which was 1980.
Yeah.
She had such a great stage name, Sean Colvin, and I had Lucy Kaplansky. Like, what kind of stage name is that? And I actually thought about changing it, but... you know, now I look at, you know, there's so many weird names out there, like Jake Gyllenhaal, and who cares? But it has been a source of pain for me that I didn't have a good stage name. Suzanne Vega, who I also met in 1980, great stage name. That's her real name.
It's a great name. It's also the name of a terrific banjo.
It is?
The Vega banjo, my goodness.
I don't know.
The Pete Seeger Vega model, you know, I mean, what can I tell you? Kaplansky, let's go back to that. Did you ever think of changing it?
I thought about changing it. I just never, I guess I must not have really wanted to change it because I didn't change it. And then by the time I really started to actually have a career, it was at that point, you know, I wasn't going to change it because people actually knew my name. So, and it's kind of cool having, I mean, my dad, you know, people, that's another thing. People come up to me who were students of my dad, and that happens a lot.
You think it's going to happen less? I mean, my mother ran the educational establishment on the West Side, and boy, in the beginning it was something. But yeah. I don't hear much anymore as a 71-year-old, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's going to happen less. Although my dad's books live on.
Oh,
so
yeah,
I do have young, I mean, this happened to me, I don't know, a month ago. Like so a couple of young algebraists said, oh yeah, we read your dad's book. Like, so the books live on, so maybe it will keep happening.
Yeah.
And my dad is smiling down, you know.
Yeah.
Thinking, oh, I'm more famous than she is.
Is there anything mathematical about your songs?
Well, I don't know if you know that I do some of my dad's songs in my shows.
Yes, I've seen that. Mm-hmm.
So that's, I mean, there's a couple of songs of my dad's that are about math. One of them is
pie?
A song about pie.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's actually, amazingly, one of the hits in my shows. Like, people ask for that more than almost anything. And it's the quirkiest, wackiest song. People love it.
Here's a song to sing about pi. Not a sigma or mu, but a well-known Greek letter too. You can have your alphas and your great five eights and omegas for a friend. But that's just what a circle does and have a beginning or an end. 3, 1, 4, 1, 5, 9 is a ratio we don't define. 2 pi times radii gives circumference you can rely. If you square the radius times the pi, you will get the circle space.
Beyond my dad's songs, you know, I don't think so. I think, though, I was always very good in math. My dad was a really talented musician. I do believe, I don't know the ins and outs of it, that whatever the part of the brain is that you know, sort of serves math and music really is the same part of the brain. But no, nothing specific. I can't say.
Do you ever give music lessons?
I never have given music lessons. My daughter is playing the drums now, although she doesn't want to learn from me, that's for sure. She has a drum teacher. I think maybe a lot of kids don't want to learn anything from their parents. Like, yeah. If I say to her, you know, honey, you're speeding up, she doesn't want to hear it from me.
Sure.
But she does love to we jam together, and she likes to play on my tunes. So I'll play a couple of my rock tunes. She's got a great rock groove thing, and she loves to do that, and I love to do it. And I've actually had her sit in with me at quite a few gigs now, and she plays like 3 or 4 songs, and then it's like I've got an instant band. And I've joked, and it's really almost not a joke, that we're like, you know, a reincarnation of the Partridge Family. There she is, the little girl on the drums, and I guess I'm David Cassidy. And I loved David Cassidy, so it's only appropriate.
Lucy, anybody ever knocked on your door and said, you guys are making too much noise?
No, we have very nice neighbors. And we have, my daughter's drum set is electronic. So it's all going on in her headphones, but you can hear tapping. But we have very, very nice neighbors, and we're very considerate and only do it during the day, during reasonable hours.
I remember the gendarme showing up in our house at 50 West 96th Street, telling us it's time to shut up. And interestingly, my room was on a shaft, and every Horneyite psychiatrist in the city, I think, was in that building. And so there was no air conditioning.
Wow. Wow.
So the windows were all open. And they were pretty ticked off, I can tell you that much.
We're not on a shaft. And no psychiatrists around. So that's lucky. Otherwise, probably we would be hearing from the cops.
Right, right. Let's go back to the album itself for a couple of minutes. Do you have postpartum when you finish an album? In other words, you've spent time on it, you've written it, most of it or a good deal of it, you walk away from it, and you've been in the studio. And you know what it's like. You can get a little depressed after a baby because you've been with this thing for so long. How about an album?
You know, I'm a very anxious, worried person in general. It's just the way I am. Take after my mother. So I'm always worried about everything until the album's done. And then I worry about, well, do people like it? So if it's done and people are liking it, I'm just, more than anything, I'm happy, but more than anything, I'm relieved. And so it came out in September, and I've been in a state of basically relief ever since. And it actually has gotten some really beautiful reviews. And even more importantly, like, my audience, oh my God, I've gotten just the nicest comments. So no, I can't say I'm sorry to see it go. I'm happy to see it go and be done with it and feel like I made the album I wanted to make. I feel good about that.
Are there any Get Even songs on your album?
Yes, funny you should ask.
Well, I heard
there's
them.
There's one. I'm not going to get any at all specific, which is called Gone, Gone, Gone. And that, you know, it's so funny because I actually started writing that like 2 years ago, and I just never could make anything of it. And then Rick, my husband, and I sat down with it. I had written a chunk of it, and then he and I just, like, in an hour, just finished it. And it is, well, I'll say it's a composite. It's not any one real person, but there are some real facts in there that you can't make up about someone. And yes, it is definitely Get Even song, and I've written a few of those, but this is the one on this album.
Something about empathy. You say your heart is oh so very open, now you can love so completely. And your kid's the most multidimensional child his teacher's ever known. I used to fall for it all. Your marriage is perfection, but you mess around on the side, 'cause you're entitled to some extracurricular fun at night. Your lover punctuates his words with his fist on the wall beside your head. He needs to express his feelings, that's what you said he said. And you believe that.
When you're sitting there with your husband, we husbands, of course, married to wonderful women, may, on some level, compete with the past. So how is it that your husband was able to help you do this? Maybe he was mad at whoever you were with all those years ago.
Yes. I don't want to get more specific, but yeah, he was right there with me. That's why. I mean, this was a shared thing.
A shared,
how's that?
Yeah. Well, that's good. What song are you most proud of in your career?
Wow. I'm awfully proud of the song 10-Year Night. And partly because that was, Rick and I wrote it together, but that was mostly mine. And I had never really, that was one of my very first songs really ever wrote, that I ever really wrote mostly myself. And I remember thinking, I challenged myself, Lucy, you got to write a song. Just do it yourself. You know, don't sit down with Rick this time. Just try it yourself. And I kept thinking, I was tortured the whole time thinking, oh my God, this is so mediocre. I'm never going to amount to anything. And I played it for Rick. It wasn't done. He helped me finish it, but I played it for Rick, and he said, this is the best thing you've ever written. And so it means a lot to me, I think, partly because of that. And it is my most popular song, and that means a lot to me. People have heard it a lot and asked for it a lot. And it's very, very, very personal, but I guess it's also got this kind of universal, like, it's kind of an I love you song, but I really wanted to write it without any cliches, without saying I love you, without saying the usual stuff. And I feel like I managed to do that. So I think that's probably the one.
Well, the album is Lucy Kaplansky Reunion. And if you look at the back, on the front, you'll see Grandma's Bake Shop in illustration. And on the back are all the cousins from the reunion. It looks like thousands of them, but it's not.
Right. Big family. I know.
It's big. Lucy Kaplansky, much love to you and for everything you've done for all of us. And we appreciate it so much. And we hope we'll be able to get you back here at the Linda Norris Auditorium. And, you know, I just think it's a remarkable career and your stuff is terrific. So, again, for all of you who want to get the album, Lucy Kaplansky Reunion.
Thank you so much for having me. So fun to talk to you. Tonight.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.
Telling you, take it from me.